What is happening, everyone? Welcome into another episode of Cheap Seats Chatter. I'm your host, David Gillespie. Alongside with me is Alex Clark. And we also have Ryan Potts joining in on the podcast, aka Splash. Hope you guys are enjoying your Friday afternoon, wherever you are in the country or the world even. Certainly a nice day outside here in the Pacific Northwest with me and Alex at a cool 73 right now. How's it over in your end, Ryan?
It's lower, it's upper 80s, low 90s here in Atlanta. Just chilling. We had some storms the other day, so didn't get to watch game one of the finals, but hey, it happens.
Well,
it's just fun to see that we're finally not storming here in Seattle.
I know, right? And that we're also at the same time past that heat wave. How did you handle that heat wave yourself, Alex?
I stayed in a car for a lot of it because I was helping out friends. And when it gets to 115, you know that outside is not the option. Outside is never the answer.
Yeah, I'm just, for me, honestly, as long as it's not scorching and as long as it's not blizzarding, I'm all good to go because, I mean, just, what was it, a week and a half ago, I was cooking like a $50 filet mignon. I mean, I was just roasting out there. So it was not my cup of tea. I like this weather. I prefer this a lot more. This is more standard Seattle, typical summer weather. So
could not just need one fan going on. Yeah, you don't need to have the whole AC. I currently have one fan going on me, and I am doing A-okay. Whereas with 115, I needed to be under constant ice and supervision.
I was like that one guy in that commercial and like where the Ride of the Valkyries is playing and they got the stereo boom in terms of the fan power that was coming my way during that heat wave, because it was just, it was unbearable for me. Like I said, good weather here in Seattle and hopefully some good weather for the All-Star game come July 14th when the game is set to take place at Coors Field in Colorado. The All-Star Game reserves were finally announced in addition to the starters last week. So now we got a feel for who's going to be representing the American League and the National League in the All-Star Game. Some of the notable decisions being made in the All-Star Game, we've got a lot of representation from the Red Sox. They lead the pack with five different guys, including Matt Barnes, Xander Bogaerts, Rafael Devers, Nathan Eovaldi, and J.D. Martinez. Blue Jays trail them at the second spot with four themselves, the Astros as well, and the Padres each with four. I was really shocked to see the Astros not draw a larger turnout. I would expect them to lead the pack considering the trend that they've been on as of lately. Currently, definitely, I would say one of the American League contenders to vie for a World Series this year. What do you guys make of some of the decisions that have been made when it came to the reserves? Who were some of the surprises that stood out to you?
So I think I'll back up your point about the Astros. There was about a month stretch that the entire team was essentially hitting like prime Freddie Freeman. Yeah. So like 320 average, 400 on base, well over 500 slugging. And this isn't like just Bregman or just Correa or just Brantley. This is the entire team, 1 through 9. This is, you know, the Maldonados of the world, Miles Straws of the world, Gurriels of the world. It was an incredible run from an entire team. And I have to imagine if Vladimir Guerrero wasn't having an all-time great season, Yuli Gurriel would have been the selection at first. And Bregman got hurt right before like voting really picked up. So he's a guy that probably makes it most years. Brantley, of course, made it. And I think Jordan Alvarez not being included is really a travesty when you see both J.D. Martinez and Nelson Cruz. Of course, Cruz is the only Twinkie on the roster, so he kind of had to be there. But I think Alvarez should have been there, so that's one big, I guess, snub for me. I would have taken Alvarez over Cruz and just made it work somewhere else.
So I'll go back real quick to the Astros point again here, saying that we are having a couple Astros that are pulling out of this the whole ceremony itself, of the whole spectacle of the All-Star game. And the reason for what some people are thinking is that they wouldn't be able to face their teammates after what had happened. I don't know how much stock I put into that. I think this could also just be a part of, you know, they want the week break to, because that's the other good thing about the All-Star break itself, is that it's basically just 4 free days off unless you're playing or doing something like that. And so maybe that could be another ultra strategy of it. I'm not quite sure. As for snubs, I mean, there are definitely some people I think that could have made it. But honestly, the more I look at this roster, I'm actually pretty impressed. There's a lot of really good names here for this, like, that I'm really happy at least made it. The Orioles, Cedric Mullins deserved it, I think, more than almost anybody else, just for the sole fact of guys having a breakout season. That's what you love to see from some of these teams, guys that are having that breakout year and are getting recognized as such. I like seeing that Mike Zunino doing well as a catcher, making it for the Rays with it. And then just the more and more you go up and look at these, especially from some of the smaller teams, it's really cool to see. With the Dodgers, I think it's really interesting the fact that they only have three representatives with Mookie Betts, Max Muncy, and Chris Taylor so far. I think that this is a really fun all-star roster, I'll be honest. There are definite snubs, I feel. But, you know, overall, you look at this top to bottom, and I'm impressed.
Yeah, I actually didn't have too many objections in this roster. From what I recall, this seemed to be more compatible with what I felt should have taken place in 2021 compared to what I felt should have taken place in previous years. So I must commend the voters, the fan voters out there, and the commissioner's office and player ballots that were submitted for the reserves. Obviously, like I said, the fans voting for the starters, players, player ballots, and commissioner's office voting for the reserves in particular, getting it right this year, you know, compared to previous years. I did have a few objections. I mean, there were a couple things with pitching that really stood out to me, notably in the National League. And I get it. Listen, I can't knock them too much because there's just so much great pitching this year in the National League in particular. Unreal what we've seen, obviously, from guys like Jacob deGrom and Kevin Gausman and Brandon Woodruff, Corbin Burns. So many pitching stalwarts out there personally representing the National League. But I felt like Freddy Peralta and Max Scherzer were guys that got snubbed very, very hard. They have been absolutely outstanding this year. Peralta having an absolute breakout year, just 24 years of age, 2.23 ERA, 129 Ks. 35% whiff rate, unreal fastball slider combo. He almost kind of reminds me of, you know, I've talked a lot about about Waskari Noah from the Atlanta Braves and his hype and his potential. He's almost like, I wouldn't say Waskari Noah 2.0 in terms of being that proven guy now, because obviously we've seen a much more significant track record of where he's played at a high level compared to Waskar, but he's almost like a more refined Waskari Noah, to where this guy's potential, I mean, frankly, the sky's the limit. And again, he's been unreal this year. Like I said, incredible fastball slider combo, 118 average against sliders, 152 against fastballs. Scherzer, we're talking about maybe one of the greatest pitchers of all time. I mean, who's still playing at an incredibly exceptional level. Unbelievable this year. 2.66 ERA, 134 Ks, a Cy Young candidate in the National League, a .88 whip, and he's not on the All-Star roster. I was frankly shocked. Listen, and I know part of it could be because of the rule that all teams must be represented in the All-Star game. Frankly, I'm going to be honest, I didn't even know that until recently. It may be embarrassing to say, but I never realized that everyone had to be represented in the All-Star game in terms of teams. So I get it on that level in terms of playing by the rules to have someone like a Herman Marquez representing, but I did not agree. Like, this for me, I would not have put him in, obviously, over someone like a Max Scherzer or Freddy Peralta. So those were two guys that really stood out to me when it came to the pitching. I thought Omar Narvaez should have gotten a little more love over JT Realmuto, also in the National League. He's been exceptional for another Brewer that's been exceptional thus far, hitting very well for averaging .302 this year. Very, very productive compared to Realmuto, who's been hitting .261. But I was really happy to see a lot of representation, with guys like, with other Nationals in particular, like Trey Turner. I was really happy to see him get into the mix of the All-Star game. He's having an unbelievable year. You're doing everything right, whether it's hitting for contact, hitting for average, stealing bases. This is him finally living up to the hype, frankly, because he's been a good player, but considering this 82-game stretch, I don't think we've ever seen him play at this high of a level and frankly, expect him to be do we expect him to be an MVP candidate in did we see him become an MVP candidate in previous years like we have seen him become this year? So really happy to see him get some love there. Again, 17 home runs, 19 stolen base, 321 batting average thus far in 2021. Did have some exceptions with the outfielders. Didn't really agree with Mookie Betts necessarily getting in there. Thought maybe guys like Tyler O'Neill, Trent Grisham could have gotten a little more love. Personally, Mookie just hasn't. We haven't seen him quite deliver as a hitter this year, and even frankly as a defender too. I mean, not to say that he's playing bad as a defender, but I just haven't seen him at his, I mean, platinum glove caliber level that we had seen him at in previous years, where he could be over the last few years the best fielder in all of baseball. Either him or Arenado, I think you can make an exceptional case for. So those were some of the guys in the National League that really stood out to me. What do you guys make, you know, speaking on that rule about representation with teams, what do you guys make of that rule that all teams should be represented in the All-Star game?
So I'll speak on this one first here, because I actually have a little bit to say on this one. When it comes to the representation rule, it sounds horrible. It's a bad idea if the All-Star game meant something. The All-Star game really means nothing. I mean, all it is, it's basically for the fans to have a way to really enjoy something cool during the summer and be able to see the best of the best really go at it. But at the same time, also, the only thing that it matters for the players is that they get that little accolade next to their name, that they made it to an All-Star game. And that's a pro, because at this point right now, the All-Star game doesn't mean, and it used to have the meaning of the winner of the All-Star game got home field advantage for the World Series, but with how people didn't really take the All-Star game seriously, it didn't make sense to have that high of a stipulation on it. So with this, I think it's honestly fine to have every team represented, because you don't want to exclude any fan bases. And since it's something that is primarily for the fans, you got to have every team there. And some of these teams, you're not going to get a lot of popularity for, like, say, the Seattle Mariners or the Baltimore Orioles or the Minnesota Twins, where the fan bases are not near as big and some of the players maybe can't shine as much just because of the situation that they're put into. I like that each team does get to have at least one representative. That's because of the fact that the game doesn't have any of these extra stakes. If they still had the stakes of, oh, the winner has the home field advantage for the World Series, then yeah, you need to be a lot more strict when it comes to it. Because at that point, now that there's something on the line, each side needs to be there to win. Whereas this is, you're getting together for a pickup game of baseball. Which, to be fair, I think it almost would be more fun at that same exact bit to just go and turn it into like a backyard baseball style of play, where you have all the people that are elected to the game and then have captains pick teams. I think that would honestly be really fun. Do like what the Pro Bowl did for the NFL a little bit ago.
That would be very intriguing. I would be very, like, you know, something like they did, yeah, with the Pro Bowl and with the NBA to some degree as well. What say you, Ryan? What do you make of that rule in particular?
So I think one thing that I noticed this year is some of these smaller teams, some of these like objectively awful teams got all-stars, legitimate all-stars. I'm just looking at the Rangers. They had three deserving all-stars. All of them made the all-star team. Joey Gallo has been phenomenal the last month or so. He leads Major League Baseball in F-War and all those dingers last month. And Adolis Garcia has been awesome in the field. He's been awesome in the batter's box. And Kyle Gibson, I had him as my AL Cy Young front runner for a decent chunk of June. So you look at Texas, and Texas was projected to be one of the worst teams in the league. They are one of the worst teams in the league. They have three All-Stars. Pittsburgh, they have two deserving All-Stars. And then you look at the Mets, they have one deserving All-Star. And it's crazy to me sometimes how the teams that really benefited this year from that one one player minimum. It's obviously DeGrom makes it under any circumstance, but the Rays, I wonder if Mike Zunino doesn't make the All-Star team if the Rays, or if there was not a rule in place. And as much as I want to like slander Major League Baseball for having painfully average players make the All-Star team, the first name that comes to mind is Sandy Alcantara, who made the All-Star game with like a 4.5 ERA or something a couple years ago. But for every situation like Alcantara, we get the Rays' only representative being Mike Zunino. And this is a Rays team that is reigning AL champions and might win the AL again, or the Orioles with Cedric Mullins, who should have been voted in as a starter, but that's a story for last week's show, or even Salvador Perez. There are some really good players with the A's, Matt Olson as well. There are some awesome players that happen to be the only representative on their team. And while DeGrom, Olson, and Perez or Mullins may have been selected no matter what the rule is, I do like how every team is represented because these are really large rosters. You look at, say, the NBA All-Star game or the NHL All-Star game. Those are much smaller in comparison to a Major League Baseball All-Star game that there's about 60 total players, maybe even more, depending on guys that like DeGrom or Correa or Altuve that just say, I'm not going. You have the issue that comes up with you. At a certain point, you're going to have 75 guys potentially that are considered all-stars. So I do think it's a solid rule that every team gets at least one person. And there's very few that are objectively awful. Like even Herman Marquez, he's had a solid season. Even Eduardo Escobar, he's had a solid season. It's just on a crappy Rockies team. And I don't even know where to begin with how bad the Diamondbacks have been this season.
Yeah, it's been rough to say the least for the Diamondbacks. That's an understatement ultimately. But I think what it boils down to, and I should have prefaced this before, but I'm just being a snob here, okay? The way I interpret the All-Star game, I know it's totally about the fans. It's about the fan experience. It's about the enjoyment of getting to watch some of your hometown heroes represent Major League Baseball on the All-Star, you know, game level. I mean, to represent amongst the other better players in the entire league, it's a special thing to get to witness, and it's for the enjoyment. It's for the aesthetic. It's not necessarily, you know, for qualification all the time. But I don't know. That's just like, that's me being the snob where I think about it in terms of correlating with someone's legacy and how getting that All-Star game selection ultimately boosts their legacy, ultimately enhances their legacy. And I just want to see guys get more fairly represented. Again, I'm totally being snobbish here, and this may be just ridiculous what I'm about to say, but if it meant, for instance, like speaking on the Astros, who I was surprised didn't get more representation, if they would have had like 7, 8, 9 guys or something to that level representing, if they had that many guys, I mean, it certainly warranted more representation this year, but 9 guys, that's quite a few. But if it got that high and they had that much representation, I'd be fine with it. Because, again, you're rewarding the best of the game. And that's what it's all about for me personally. But I totally get it being just about the fan experience, it being about the enjoyment of the game. And you want to see your guys represented from the hometown. So I'm not up in arms about it. I don't know. It's just my opinion, but I respect others feeling differently. But, yeah, I felt pretty good about this, you know, the selections this year. Another notable snubs, I felt like maybe Sean Manaea and Chris Bassett could have gotten a little more love out of Oakland. You could have maybe made case for Robbie Ray and Jose Barrios, I think, over someone like Nathan Eovaldi. With all due respect to him representing Boston, who is obviously my team, that's the team I cheer for. I'm happy to see him get he's had a very good year. Considering the level he's played at in previous seasons. So I'm happy to see him play at a high level, but I would have liked to see those guys get a little more representation. So I didn't really, again, that, but that really, maybe I would say probably third base in Machado, who's driven in more runs, driven in a staggering amount of runs with 59 this year. And Justin Turner as well, who's also having a tremendous year. I felt like he could have gotten a little more love, batting 303. He got a 393 OBP. So a lot of great numbers coming from him. And he's kind of been someone who's always been on the cusp of getting to an All-Star game, seems like year in and year out. But he hasn't gotten a ton of love throughout his career. I think he only has one All-Star game appearance in his entire career. But outside of those guys, I didn't really have too many objections. It's just, I don't know, I'm nitpicking here. So it's really just coming down to trivial matters right now, because it's supposed to be for enjoyment, and I'm still going to enjoy the game nonetheless.
Yeah, so I got something kind of on that same line here. And this is maybe something that this may sound almost anti-snobbish of me, but maybe snobbish, I'm not quite sure. When it comes to this, you brought up the idea of legacy. And yes, this is definitely a legacy thing. Like, where it is an accolade to be nominated to the All-Star Game, or to be chosen, specifically chosen to be in the All-Star Game. And so it does hurt that, but I have, on that same kind of thing, to argue a little bit more for how they have it here. You brought up a guy like Max Scherzer not making the roster, mm-hmm. which, you know, Max Scherzer is still Max freaking Scherzer. But at the same time, what's one more All-Star to him? What is one All-Star where, say, like a guy like Yusei Kikuchi, who is getting his first All-Star nod here, yeah. It means a lot more to some of these players that have not been to an All-Star game than it does to these guys that have been to maybe 4, 5, or 6. And that's something I like is, yes, the All-Star game is the best of the best. But at the same time, if you have a guy that is only having, like, that is finally having that big breakout year, and you don't know if they're going to have that again, I like the idea of giving some of these guys that may not be always getting that kind of representation, give them that thing, so at least they have that as a little trophy on their trophy case. You know, and some people can use the idea of, oh, if more people have it, it loses its meaning. I get that. But not everybody also catches fire like some of these players, like Cedric Mullins. We don't know if he's going to be able to do this again, but we need to reward having this amazing season that he's having. For Mike Zunino, yes, he's not doing the best out of everybody, but you know what? He still was good enough to say, hey, you know what? If we need a catcher, this is a guy that we trust to be in that position. I like seeing that some of these guys that may not be getting that much kind of love, that don't normally get all this, are getting a little bit more respect on it. Whereas, again, some of the guys that have been to a billion games, yes, we love to see them, and they definitely do deserve it. What I think maybe an even better thing is have the voting and have a lot of the reserves just go full All-Star, and then win, because you know inevitably people are going to drop out. That's when you start looking to, okay, who doesn't have representatives? And maybe go from there.
Yeah, it seems like, and there have been a couple guys that have dropped out, a couple Astros, Carlos Correa has dropped out this year, and Jacob DeGrom as well. So we've seen a couple guys, and Jose Altuve as well, going to be skipping the All-Star game. So there's going to be some voids left unfilled that will be hopefully filled by guys that are deserving. I don't know. It's just, again, I'm totally nitpicking here. I'm totally being an accuracy snob here. But I don't know. It's an OCD thing, I guess.
It's a good opinion what you've got there, because you make logical sense here. Because the All-Star game is just that, the All-Star game. It's not the, hey, you done pretty good game. And yeah. I definitely understand. One thing I'm going to do real quick, though, before we get too much farther into this, we're going to play everyone's favorite game. Alex will defend the Mariners a little bit here. And there are two people that I think actually legitimately could make the All-Star roster this year. And that is, from Seattle, Kendall Graveman has been absolutely insane this year as the team's breakout closer, where he has an ERA still after over 25 innings, still has an ERA of under 1. With a whip of just over 0.6. that's insane for how much this guy has been dominating here on the mound. I mean, he also just had a great outing against the Yankees, almost hitting one run at Odor, having the entire team stare him down, and he just standing there going like, what? That was brilliant. And then on top of it, J.P. Crawford, we were talking about him before the show a little bit, a guy that is one of the best defensive players in baseball, and the offense is really starting to come around. A little bit ago, he was actually leading all players in Major League Baseball in defensive war at 1.6. It's now dropped to a 1.3 and has a war of just below 3 at 2.7. So I think that's a guy that definitely is deserving of having an all-star spot as well, because this one isn't as much with the voting. When it comes to the reserves, it goes down to the commissioner's office. Yeah. So I think at that point, that's a really good thing, because then it means that players that actually have done pretty darn well but maybe aren't seen as often get that opportunity to be like, okay, yep, you're elected to the All-Star game for your merits, as opposed to the popularity contest, which is what the All-Star voting process is.
I do like that stipulation when it comes to the reserve voting, that it's not solely up to the fans. I like the balance of both, because you want to have the representation of both the league's voting and the league's opinion and the fans voting and their opinion. So I value both, and I'm glad that both are a part of it. And like you said, Kendall Graveman, yeah, he's been outstanding this year. Certainly done a great job stepping up as their new closer. It's been a rough, rough year, to say the least, for Rafael Montero. And Kendall Graveman has been taking that call to action in just absolute tremendous fashion. I mean, just like you said, a sub-1 ERA. An incredible year this far for the Mariners, who are above 500. And listen, it's early on, it's first half of the year. I'm really hoping they can pull it out to get into the second half of the season and the final month of the season in September, still remaining at least above 500 to build something for the future and to just put an end to this playoff drought, because it's just been miserable. I mean, it's been 20 years now since the last one of the playoffs. Let's be hopeful that that they change that and they can finally put an end to that unfortunate drought that is the longest in all of baseball. But Ryan, you talked about how you had mentioned that you wanted to say something about the legacy when it comes to the All-Star game. What more did you have to say on that?
So often we talk about the guys that are teetering between 0 career All-Star games and 1 career All-Star games. And with all due respect to Yusei Kikuchi, he's not a guy that's going to just start racking up All-Star games. He's probably going to have 1, maybe 2. And you look at Max Scherzer's career, and what's the difference between 7 All-Star games and 8 All-Star games? I don't think it's very much. And when you go back through, say, a Hall of Fame candidacy, I don't know how many times Barry Bonds made the All-Star game. I don't really care how many times he made the All-Star game. Because even, or take last year, Freeman and Abreu, MVPs, no All-Stars. And if you're just scrolling through Baseball Reference, oh, how did they win MVP and they weren't All-Stars? I think the value of the All-Star game should be more on the fans than player accolades moving on, because if you're Scherzer, your first line of your Hall of Fame plaque isn't going to be 7-time All-Star. It's going to be 3-time Cy Young Award winner. He's top 10 in Cy Young, like, vote shares ever.
Exactly.
He's been an MVP top 10 finisher 3 times. No one's going to care that he was snubbed from the 2021 All-Star game. They're going to see, oh, he has a sub-1 whip. That's really good. Oh, he's on pace to strike out 260, and he's going to get to 3,000 strikeouts later this season. Oh, that's awesome. Or they're going to see, oh, he has another sub-3 ERA. And Scherzer could very well, let's say for the sake of argument, Jacob deGrom continues to allow runs, Max Scherzer doesn't allow any runs, and he wins the Cy Young. No one's going to care that he wasn't an All-Star. It's going to be a CYA-1 next to his name that people care about.
Oh, I totally echo that sentiment that that the All-Star game does not have as much value as certain other things. But when it comes to awards at the same time, in particular with MVPs and Cy Youngs, those are also voted as well on who gets that award. So by different people, obviously, with the media being more involved with that as opposed to the All-Star game. But But so I think honestly what it boils down to is what really matters when it comes to someone's legacy is their production, is what they do on the field, are the statistics, are what you see in big moments throughout the season, throughout the postseason, just sometimes the off factor as well, just seeing gargantuan hitters that were just so intimidating at the plate that may get more respect than others just because of how incredibly physically talented they were. I mean, that sometimes plays a role in it, you know? So I think those things come into play. But I'll tell you one thing that I love about this All-Star game. It is the storylines that are embedded in this particular year. It's been an unbelievable year with so many different stories to note. And within this All-Star game, a lot of intriguing storylines. You talked about Cedric Mullins having an outstanding year. This guy was a 13th round draft pick. And here he is representing the All-Star game in his fourth year and his first full-time season where he's actually playing. Well, you know, he did play 48 games last year, but in terms of playing, you know, on pace to playing 160 games plus this year. So really awesome to see that from him, considering where his trajectory probably was at the beginning of his MLB career. Adolis Garcia, someone who didn't make the Rangers roster initially, had to rely on injury just to make the roster, in fact. Now here he is as a reserve in the All-Star game. He's been a tremendous power hitter, tremendous center fielder. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as a starter from first base, leading all vote getters and the youngest ever to do it. And then, of course, we get to maybe the biggest storyline of them all. And that is Mr. Shohei Ohtani himself out of the Los Angeles Angels having an unbelievable and unprecedented year. We're talking the first ever two-way All-Star in Major League history. Unbelievable what we've seen from him. This guy is doing everything you could possibly fathom happening on a baseball field. I mean, he's hitting .279, a solid average, slugging .700 this year, OBP .360 plus, leading the league in home runs with 32, and he's been on an unbelievable stretch of the last 20 games in particular, going .315 in that stretch with 15 home runs and 1,000 slugging over that stretch too. Crazy, crazy production right now. He leads the league in extra base hits and home runs. He's also, when it comes to his pitching, which may even be more special than his hitting, depending on who you ask. I want to get into that a little more in a bit, but he's got a 3.49 ERA right now with 87 Ks and 67 innings pitched, 1.209 whip right now. Sensational what we're seeing from him. Just unreal. Unreal. And this is also someone who's only getting started, really, frankly. I mean, he's only 27 right now. He came in at age 24. He's already in his fourth year now, and he's had a productive career this far, but now he's finally getting rewarded with an All-Star game vote. Came over earlier than guys like Ichiro Suzuki, Daisuke Matsuzaka, Masahiro Tanaka, and Hideki Matsui. And speaking of Matsui, broke his MLB record for most home runs by a Japanese player. And what we're seeing here, absolutely unprecedented. When it's all said and done, where will this season go down historically for Ohtani?
Well, so when it comes to Shohei, like, I will say this outright, that while I still will always be slightly salty that he did not come to Seattle when everything was pointing that he was going to come to Seattle, you can't not be impressed by what he's doing right now. Like you said, this is unprecedented. The closest that we really have to this is Babe Ruth back when he was a pitcher. And even then, he didn't do the hit. He didn't hit that much. He hit a little bit, but he became just a full-time hitter later on in his career. This is the first time that we are seeing someone that is being an excellent pitcher and hitter in the exact same season. And a player that, like you say, like you just very emphatically went through all the stats with it. This year, we have a pitcher. A pitcher who is their primary position, leading the league in triples, homers, slugging percentage. This guy is insane. He has an OPS now of over 1,000. And this guy only, like, this guy does bat basically every day, but he pitches every fifth day as well. People keep making the idea when it comes to this, that being a two-way player is near impossible because of how hard it is to play Major League Baseball, which that statement alone just proves how good Shohei Ohtani is being right now. There is still a lot left to go in this season. We're only at the halfway mark. Can Shohei Ohtani fall off? Yes. Do I want him to fall off? Absolutely not. We are witnessing history right now. And this will forever go down in history that Shohei is going to be the first ever All-Star Game attendee as two different positions, as a hitter and as a pitcher. And what I wonder is, because we talked about how hard it is to do this kind of thing, is, are we going to see this again in the future? Because we've always thought that, okay, you know, if a guy is good at hitting, he's never going to be a pitcher. If a guy is good at pitching, he's never going to be a hitter. We're starting to see that, you know what, it is physically possible to do. Shohei is the benchmark for it now. So I wonder if we will see this again, and if we don't see this again, this is going to be marked down as truly groundbreaking for Major League Baseball. And the biggest thing I think I want to make sure that people take away from this, from what we're seeing from Shohei, is that he is being incredible in both aspects. Yes, the hitting more than the pitching, but the pitching still isn't bad. I mean, take a look at his pitching stats overall this season. Heck, 3.49 ERA over 67 innings pitched. I mean, he's walked 35 guys to 87 strikeouts and a whip of 1.2. I mean, what more do you want? This guy, yes, it can get a little bit better in the pitching aspect, but we have certain pitchers that are making the All-Star game with worse pitching stats than that. And on top of those pitching stats, remember, he is still as a main hitter too. They were talking about how he will both pitch and hit in this All-Star game, and I cannot wait to see what he does in those opportunities.
I think one of the most fascinating things to note too on top of this is that, as special as he's been as a hitter this year, he hasn't taken a single swing of batting practice all season. That is unreal.
Okay, I don't know how much stock I'm putting. That was a thing that came up from the Angels batting coach. And sometimes he's also been known for just saying things to say things. I don't know how much stock I'm really putting in that he's never taken a swing at batting practice. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, I, I'm not there at the field, so I can't speak on that. But if that's true, that's just frankly unbelievable to see him put up this production and not have that much practice in between. What say you, Ryan?
I was doing some research on Ohtani for another job the other day, and I came across this number. Since Barry Bonds in 2004, no player has slugged 700 in a season. Hey, look. Mr. Shohei Ohtani, a pitcher, is slugging 700. That is incomprehensible. Even like Juan Soto last year had this all-time great season, 695. Think of all the Albert Pujols seasons. Think of any Chipper Jones season, Chris Davis when he hit 50 home runs, Giancarlo Stanton, Christian Yelich, Bellinger, Ryan Howard. None of them got to 700. Shohei Ohtani is at 700 right now. Do I think he's going to continue? I don't know, but if you want to see something fun, if you want to, I don't know where in the world we still have like social distancing where places are closed, but if you want a roller coaster that's really high up in the air, go look at Shohei Ohtani's expected WOBA chart on Baseball Savant. It's just going up, 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 up. You know, it's there's peaks and valleys, sure, but the peaks and valleys are 100% above average. Like the gap between his lowest point in his last 50 at bat or his last 50 plate appearances and the league average line is astronomical at this point. And it's a phenomenal season. We've mentioned it, leads league in triples, leads the majors in home runs, the 700 slugging percentage. And I'm just interested to see how he's used in the All-Star game. Is his appearance in the All-Star game as both a hitter and a pitcher, as one entity? So hypothetically, he begins the game pitching. As soon as you take him out for pitching, he can't do anything in the game. Or are they going to count him as two entities with essentially a batter Shohei and a pitcher Shohei because it's the All-Star game?
So what's really cool about that, and that goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the All-Star game not really having a meaning to it, is that even the umpires are going to be pretty lenient on some of these rules. So I don't see why not of them going and saying, oh, yeah, let's just, yeah, you want to hit two? Yeah, go ahead. It'll be fine. They will allow a lot of things for this. So I would not be surprised if they say that Shohei, you start the All-Star game, and that he's pulled after an inning, and then when it comes to the DH spot later on, they just put him back in. I would not be surprised.
I certainly hope so. I really hope so. I want to see that. Just to see him be on the mound and be at the plate, have the best of both worlds. It's a special moment. It's a special occasion. Why not reward him in both aspects with that? Because he's just been unbelievable this year. This guy, he does it all. I mean, he's a good base runner. He's a good power hitter. He's a pretty solid contact hitter on top of that, too. He can touch 100 on the radar, folks. It's unbelievable what we're seeing this guy do in both aspects of his game. I mean, as again, on the mound and at the plate. Either way you slice it, this guy's just unreal. He's on another level. He's out of this stratosphere. He's near the top two in average exit velocity and hard hit percentage. Crushing fastballs in particular for .795 slugging this year. This guy just, he's unbelievable. And let you, speaking on that note that you were bringing up earlier, Alex, about maybe this could be a potential model for years to come with future players. Do you guys see that playing out in terms of maybe there being more two-way guys in the near future, or are we quite a bit away from that becoming a reality?
So, okay, going back to what I had said on this, I also said very clearly with all this that this is a very hard thing to do. Being able to manage not just one aspect of the game, but two at the exact same time is something that is very unprecedented. I'm going to bring this a little bit to the NFL for a second and say this is a Sean McVay type situation. Where what I mean by that is that it's very realistic that that people will try and emulate this more and more and more as we go along throughout the next coming years of baseball. But will they be able to capture the same magic? And I'm not sure they'll be able to. Because that's something that I want to see happen. I think would be amazing if it did happen. I'm not sure if it will actually work again going forward. We're going to see, I have a feeling that within the next couple of years, we're going to see a lot of guys in minor league baseball try to become two-way players. Because all of us, like, we know this just as well. Players, like, will love to try and pitch, and they aren't as good at it. Again, we love it whenever we see a position player go take the mound. But they've always grown up, like, you know, learning how to pitch. A lot of the best players we see in baseball today were the star players on their, you know, little league teams or their high school teams. And a lot of times they pitched because they had the strongest arms. So now you're going to see a lot of guys think, okay, you know what, maybe I can do this two-way thing. We see Shohei doing it. We see other people trying it. What are we going to see going forward? I think for a while, didn't Austin Riley try to be a two-way player as well? I remember hearing something about that. I could be 100% wrong on that. And if I'm 100% wrong, please blast me.
No, yeah. It wasn't true.
Okay, it was not true. Okay, yeah, then go ahead, fully blast me.
No,
Alex,
jeez.
Gosh, I'm fired again. No, anyway, like you see this, I think we're going to see an influx of these players that will be able to try because now we've seen that in the major league atmosphere, it can work. Does that mean it's going to work? No, but it can work. And that's going to be the key when it comes to all of this, is that we're going to see an influx of this going forward, and maybe, you know, one will work. But that's still a little bit ways out to be, for it to be like an everyday thing.
I do want to point out there are some players that have some major league experience. I'm going to point at Brendan McKay of the Tampa Bay Rays. He has 49 innings, or in 2019, he had 49 innings on the mound and 11 plate appearances as a DH specifically. In his 11 plate appearances, albeit a small sample size, he did hit a home run and he did draw a walk, and he has a a career OPS plus of 102. On the mound, he was slightly less successful. He has an ERA in the fives, but he's a guy that when he was at Vanderbilt, is it Vanderbilt?
I forget where his alma mater is. I believe it's Louisville. Brennan McKay.
Okay, yeah, my mistake. When he was at Louisville, he did win the Golden Spikes Award, ACC Baseball Player of the Year, and he won the John Ulrud Award for like success as a two-way player, oddly enough. So I think there are going to be emulators, of course, like Alex mentioned, the McVay emulators across the league, Zach Taylor. Everyone's the next McVay, and everyone's going to try to be the next Shohei Ohtani. But with Ohtani, the mix of pure power, both as a pitcher and as a hitter, it's going to be hard to match. And if you can't, if you don't slug like Ohtani, you're not going to have as much success in the batter's box. If you don't throw as hard as Ohtani, you're unlikely to have as much success as Ohtani does on the mound. It's very hard to hit a baseball as hard as Ohtani does. He has the hardest hit ball in baseball this season. He's in the 96th percentile in average exit velocity. And then on the mound, the only guy that throws harder is Jacob DeGrom. And that combination, I think, is what makes Ohtani so rare of a specimen. I think there will be guys that can play both, say, right field and start on the mound a couple days later. Brendan McKay, I know the Reds had someone in their organization that transitioned back and forth and did so fairly well. I know Hunter Green, when he was in high school, he played first base a lot. And even, like, if you're the Mets, why not throw Jacob DeGrom out in the field when he's not pitching? Because he's a better hitter than anyone on your team right now, which is odd to say. But there will be emulators. There will be guys that try to do what Ohtani does. Ohtani just does it to such degree that I don't know if that can be replicated. And Alex, I think the former Brave, or the Brave you were thinking of, was Christian Bethencourt.
Yeah, no, I wasn't thinking of Bethencourt, even though I do. I just remember seeing that there was a player in minor league baseball that was doing it. I remember Christian Bethencourt, though, being that fun thing where he was a catcher and then turned reliever. And then I think they brought him back to being a catcher again.
Mm-hmm.
But that was also just because he couldn't hack it as a pitcher. But right. No, I just remember seeing something about where there was a guy that was a two-way player, and I thought it was Riley. Like I said, I'm fully okay to be wrong.
I think you're thinking of Michael Lorenzen, maybe, for the Cincinnati Reds. He's a reliever. Maybe. Right now.
That's what I was trying to think of.
Although I will say, thank you very much for bringing up the Brendan McKay one, because that is one of the ones that I think is probably most prevalent in today's baseball next to Shohei Ohtani. Because, again, he's still trying to figure it all out, but of a lot of the pitchers, he's one that has really figured it out with the play, as anyone who has played MLB The Show 20 knows that his Future Stars card absolutely raked.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable what we're seeing. And there's been a couple of two-way players that have gotten to see some action. You guys obviously know Brendan McKay, for instance, and, you know, a few others. And Michael Lorenzen, though, has been someone who's gotten a little more action, has played a lot of outfield. I believe he's played like 33 games as an outfielder on top of being predominantly a reliever right now for the Reds. He's currently on the disabled list. But he's seen action at both sides as late as 2020. So he's been another experiment that they've been toying with throughout his career to see what he can do well and see if he can contribute in both aspects in both aspects of pitching and hitting and fielding as an outfielder. So, it'd be interesting to see what happens from there on out. And he started at the same time as Shohei Ohtani back in 2018 when Ohtani was a rookie. But some other notable ones, obviously Babe Ruth, everyone knows that. Maybe the greatest baseball player of all time. I think it's self-explanatory that, you know, when we mention his name and what you think of when you think of his capability as a player as a whole, certainly was a hybrid pitcher and outfielder, led the league in ERA actually 1 year too when he was playing in for the Boston Red Sox prior to joining the Yankees, where he didn't pitch quite as much. But he was a hybrid player with the Red Sox starting out in his career. I don't know if you guys remember Rick Ankiel. He started out as a pitcher, almost won Rookie of the Year back in 2000, and then resorted to becoming an outfielder starting in 2007. And was a pretty good, that's a pretty good pop. Slugged .507 in 2008. With 25 home runs, the guy could hit for power. He was pretty decent. A lot of the change came as a result of injuries. Like, he had Tommy John and knee problems. So he ended up moving around a lot on the field, probably as a result of that, too. And then there have been some famous MLB Hall of Famers who played in the Negro Leagues, like Leon Day and Martin DeHigo and Ted Radcliffe. A couple guys back in the early days of baseball, the early 1920s or so, 1930s and 40s. They got to see some action on both sides of the plate. But again, he does everything well. It's unbelievable. What do you guys, real quick, what do you think his biggest strength is when it comes to his play? Is it his hitting or is it his pitching?
Oh, 100% the hitting. The hitting is absolutely incredible. And the fact that I like from him a lot is that they were saying a couple years ago that he had the power but didn't have the discipline to be a hitter. Well, now he has that discipline and he has that vision. He's a very, very destructive hitter, as we've seen with him being, again, one of the major league leaders in home runs out of time. He's also got speed, too. Remember, he's also leading the league in triples. Like, that's pretty impressive on top of all of that. Talk about a true six-tool player.
What about you, Ryan? What do you think is his biggest strength between the two?
It's definitely the power hitting for me. And like Alex mentioned, Ohtani has been walking a lot more this year, the whole play discipline thing. He's in the 70th percentile in walk rate in baseball, which is awesome. He still strikes out a lot. He whiffs a lot. But hey, when you lead baseball and expected wOBA, it happens. When you hit baseballs as hard as Shohei Ohtani does, I'm okay with a few extra strikeouts here or there. And he's 92nd percentile sprint speed, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, and I will be totally honest that when I write up my MVP of the first half article in a couple days, I'm still leaning Vladimir Guerrero, although Ohtani is trimming that gap. And I just, the pitching, Ohtani is so all over the place. And his expected pitching data is not as good as you might think it is, because he's perceived as, oh yeah, he's a superstar pitcher, but he's more like a, I don't know. The Angels, of course, exacerbate this, and he looks like the ace on the Angels. I don't think he can be the best pitcher on a team that does anything. I think he can be a solid number three guy. He strikes out a lot of batters, 85th percentile in strikeout rate, but he walks as much as anyone in baseball. And you look at the 3.49 ERA, and you couple that with an expected ERA that had been a run higher than he had a blow up start against the Yankees. So it's pitching for sure, or I'm sorry, it's the power hitting for sure, until he figures out how to consistently find the strike zone, because I don't think you can be an ace with a 14th percentile walk rate.
I probably have to disagree with the fact that he doesn't have the potential to be an ace. I'm not saying he's an ace necessarily yet, because again, did he warrant getting to the All-Star game as a pitcher? There could be a small argument to be made for that, because he's maybe got certainly with the speed alone on his fastball is just intimidating, to say the least. Like you said, very few pitchers throw harder than him in all of baseball. And he's also got one of the best splitters in all of baseball. It's certainly up there, with the likes of like a Kevin Gausman, who may have the best, may be the best splitter throwing pitcher in all of baseball. It's in that high ranking. You know, it's top two or three splitters. He's got an incredible, incredible splitter. I mean, the whiff rate is just staggering with what he brings in that particular part of his pitching arsenal. Surrendering just a 103 batting average right now on that pitch particularly. I want to ask one final quick question, because I don't want to get too much in this, because we're only halfway through the season. But being that he's a designated hitter and a pitcher, he would technically be, when it's all said and done, if this were to happen, the first designated hitter to win an MVP if that were to play out. Do you believe he has that potential to be the first MVP as a designated hitter historically? Because it's never happened before.
Yeah, I kind of take a slight exception to that, because I don't think he's going to be a MVP as a designated hitter. He's going to be the very first ever MVP as a two-way player. Because when you look at a player and what they've done in baseball, you can't just look at one thing that they've done. You got to look at everything that they do. Because, I mean, technically, you could look at, say, a DeGrom, or you could look at another pitcher and say, well, when they only hit 100. But a lot of times you're not going to look at it as much, but I think it should be looked at least a little bit. On this, for Ohtani, the MVP stands for most valuable player. And that's something that I think gets lost in, because when, especially when people say that Guerrero should be the lead, and I mean, it's not absurd to say that Guerrero should be the leader right now, because he's a very good baseball player. But when you look at players that give your team value, and what player is the one that gives your team the most value, I think right now the easy choice right there is Shohei Ohtani. Because for Ohtani, he is a pitcher that is at a good level. Not the best right now, as we've said. He has the potential to maybe become an ace. But right now, still a very serviceable pitcher that is playing very well. And then as a hitter, is absolutely demolishing it. So you don't just look at him as a pitcher that's basically trying to take away things that he's already done in baseball, which I don't think is fully fair to him. So right now, he's not going to go in as a DH. He's not going to win the award as DH. He's going to win the award as the two-way player that he is.
One thing that I want to throw out there is when he doesn't pitch, he's actually hurting himself a little bit. When you factor in what WAR is, right, wins above replacement, when he is listed as a designated hitter and some random scrub for the Angels goes out on the mound and has a blow-up start, Ohtani is getting compared to every other DH in the league. So technically, when he hits a home run as a pitcher and he's the one starting that particular game, he's helping himself out in WAR. And I just think that that's the most hilarious thing to me, that if he has a week, if let's say he hits a home run on Monday that he's not starting, and then the next day he hits a home run but he is the starting pitcher, that Monday home run is less valuable in terms of WAR than if it was on Tuesday, which I think it's just hilarious how he can hit essentially the same home run, but it means totally different depending on if he's pitching that day or if he's being a DH that day. And I did some looking into his WAR, and at this point, just in terms of batting WAR, he is on pace for about a 7, which is just below MVP level. But when you consider that he is a DH and that he has negative positional value and no fielding value, because I think he would be a pretty solid fielder if he played right field.
I agree with that, yeah.
And he's a great base runner as well. So you factor in, if you take out the positional correction, because he's really a pitcher that is getting into the lineup more times as a DH, he's on pace to have one of the greatest DH seasons ever. There's, I believe, one Edgar Martinez season and maybe one Ortiz season that's broken 7 WAR. And Ohtani's on pace to do that. And then, of course, you factor in he has a 1.6, at the time of me writing whatever I was writing, had a 1.6 pitching WAR and a 3.6 batting WAR. So you've extrapolated that out, 10.4 WAR, the only active players better than that, I think, is only Betts. I know Trout had a year that was around 10.5, but Ohtani, incredible season, of course, and it's just funny to me how he can hit a home run as a DH and it doesn't technically count as much as if he does it when he's a starting pitcher.
Yeah. Speaking on Ortiz, as a Boston Red Sox fan, I certainly was disappointed to not have seen an MVP go to Ortiz during that dominant stretch in the mid-2000s where he was just on an absolute tear, especially when he hit 54 home runs in 2006. And then his final, last hurrah of his career in 2016, where he finished 6th that year. I really was hoping that he would get some MVP love, but it hasn't happened yet. This would be the first time ever. A lot of people may think of Frank Thomas as the first ever designated hitter to win an MVP. He was a career DH, but he didn't win the back-to-back MVPs in 93 and 94 as a DH. It was as a first baseman. So if Ohtani were to win it, it would be the first time ever. It certainly would be fascinating to see that play out. Obviously, he's got some competition with a guy like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Maybe Carlos Correa could give a push, too, when it's all said and done, if he continues to build on his recent success. But we'll see how that plays out when it's all said and done. Speaking of All-Stars hailing from representing out of the state of California. We're going to get a little into a little bit of sign and trade, and we're going to talk about one of the Cy Young Award contenders in the National League right now, and Kevin Gausman. We were talking a little bit about him earlier and his effective splitter. He's currently on an expiring deal with the San Francisco Giants. Do you guys think that he needs to be re-signed to the Giants? How should they handle his contract? Because right now, he's having an unbelievable year with a 1.74 ERA. That's second in all of baseball. Third in WHIP right now. You know, he's got over 116 strikeouts as well. And it's been predominantly on two pitches in his fastball and splitter. They've accounted for 87% approximately of his usage rate. And like I said, very effective against that, very effective against opposing hitters with that splitter, 103 average against them, 144 slugging, and a 50% whiff rate, which only trails Ohtani and Frankie Montas out of Oakland. But that's also the highest out of anyone who's thrown it for more than 300 times, which he is the only player, and by a wide margin. No one's even, I think that he's got about 300 plus pitches more of the splitter in particular than the number two guy in all of baseball. So just an unbelievable year he's been having, especially with what he's been able to accomplish with that splitter in particular. Do you guys think they need to resign him to a long-term deal? How should they handle their his contract moving forward after this 2021 season?
Overall, I think with Kevin Gausman, he's a very interesting case because he's already been pitching for 9 years. He's made his first debut game in 2013 at age of 22. Right now, he's age 30. This is a very interesting case right now because Gausman has done pretty well over the last year and then coming into this year. Last year, again, in the shortened season, a 3.62 ERA. And this year, again, you said the 1.74 ERA on top of all that, also right now has a WAR of 4.5. Absolutely incredible. This is one of these cases where you have to make a very interesting choice. You have to try and extrapolate to see if this is going to be a Nelson Cruz, where the player really bloomed after, as we got into what would be like the halfway point into their career. Or is this going to be a flash in the pan where a player does well for a couple of years, gets a big deal, and then goes back to being what they were? And in this case, I'm going to say that with the Giants, that this is what you're going to get. I feel like this is a player that is going to keep doing well, going to keep doing better. Don't 100% call it, but that's just what I'm predicting. What I'm seeing from Gausman. And this is a team that right now is still in a very odd stage because they're winning, but they're also, the Souls have been in that kind of rebuilding stage too. So why not have a good pitcher to kind of build around? And I think Gausman has not only the ability, but also is a veteran presence, which for a lot of young guys, having that veteran presence is very much needed. It's very much necessary to have these players so that they can kind of grow up a little bit more and learn from players that have been in the show a little bit longer. Especially now, him teaming up with Buster Posey is a dream battery. Like, I don't think anyone can doubt that right now. That those two together, put together on the same field, is one of the best batteries in baseball today. But I really like what I'm saying for Gausman. I think this is decently sustainable, not at 1.74. I think the ERA by the end of the season will be probably a little closer to 3. But overall, if you're getting a good pitcher who's going to play well and is also going to be a good mentor for younger players that are coming up, you've got to extend him.
So when I look at Gausman, you see the 1.74 ERA. So I jump over to StatCast and say, how's his expected ERA? What is he doing? So I'll look at his FIP first, 2.62 FIP. That's very good. There is about a run different between his ERA and his FIP, which isn't great, but it just means he's not allowing many hits, which he isn't, 5.0 per game. And then you look at the expected data, and he's, you know, top in the top 10 percentile in expected WOBA, expected ERA, chase rate. All the signs point to him being a very good pitcher. Maybe not Cy Young caliber, because he, as far as I'm concerned, would be the Cy Young if Jacob DeGrom wasn't having the greatest pitching season ever. I think moving forward, you have to approach Gausman as he's going to be an ace caliber guy. There could be some ebbs and flows to that. There are going to be some months that he could be the best pitcher on the planet, you know, and there could be some months that, hey, he allows a couple homers, maybe allows like a 3-run homer here, a grand slam here, and all of a sudden you have a blow up start. I know he didn't pitch particularly well the other day, but if you guys had to guess, there's one pitcher in baseball that has two of the top five pitches in terms of run value. Do you think that player is more likely to be Jacob DeGrom or Kevin Gausman? Just take a guess.
I'd expect it to be DeGrom, you know?
Kevin Gausman.
It's got to be Gausman. With how you worded that, it has to be Gausman.
Yeah, so he has the number two pitch in baseball, his splitter, at a run value of -19. Only Carlos Rodon's four-seamer has a -22 is better. DeGrom comes in third with a -15 on his four-seam fastball. And then you turn around, Kevin Gausman standing right there in fifth place with his four-seamer. And then Jacob DeGrom slider is ninth place at -14 runs. It's actually, they're both tied, I guess. So I misread that, but that's okay. You have nine pitches in baseball that have a run value of -14 or better. Kevin Gausman has two. Jacob DeGrom has two. That's pretty good company to be in, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, of course, you have the expectation with Gausman in his first, 200 games in baseball was that he's a pretty average pitcher. He was really good last year. He had a 121 ERA plus. But for his career, 2013 to 2020, perfectly average 100 ERA plus. I know he pitched pretty well with Atlanta for one season, then blew up the second season. But I think you take the risk with Gausman. He is only 30. So, yeah, he has 9 years under his belt, but he is only 30. So he might be a guy that he's on a one-year $18.9 million deal. He might be a guy that you give maybe 3 years, $20 million a year or so. 3 years, $60 million, $65 million. I think I'd be okay with that. I would want a shorter leash on the contract, but I do think he can be a guy that when the Giants bring up Joey Bart soon and you are looking at the future of the Giants and you're replacing some of the old guys in that locker room, like the Buster Posey's of the world, I think Gausman can be a guy that is bridging you from this 2020. I think it's a blip in the radar. I think the Giants are overachieving a little bit, but he's a guy that you can have between this overachieving and when you get the Joey Barts of the world and you get the rest of the prospect pool up and running. He can be a guy that if he's the ace on that team, I'd be okay with it.
Yeah, I agree with the short-term leash in terms of him signing only a three-year deal. I'd actually probably bump it up to more like $25 million personally, because right now he's earning about $18 million, which is ranked 16th. $18.9 million, which is ranked 16th in all of baseball for pitchers' salaries. So he may be looking for that type of money, and I'd be okay with $25 million per year over 3 years, so $75 million in total. But I wouldn't break the bank with him and expect him to pay him like he's the best pitcher in all of baseball. And especially with the Giants too, they're only 12th in payroll right now in all of baseball, so they're not someone who's generally willing to spend as much and flirt with the luxury tax a little bit. Like I said, yeah, I would just keep it to $25 million per year. That sounds good for a short-term deal, though, because again, while he is only 30, he is over that 30 hump at the same time, and I feel that to make it any longer than 5 years, it could be a little risky for someone who's having a special year this year. But we haven't seen that happen throughout the course of his career in any other season quite like it has in 2021. So I would say leave it at that personally. But it's unreal what he's been able to accomplish this year. I mean, the Giants are the hottest team in all of baseball right now with the way they play. And it's certainly the biggest surprise. I don't think anyone foresaw that coming with the fact that they're also in the division with the San Diego Padres and the LA Dodgers, two of the arguable top NL contenders heading into 2021 spring training. So, yeah, again, I would. It's just been unbelievable to see what he's been able to accomplish. Again, leaning predominantly on two pitches. And a correction on that note about the splitter pitch total in terms of rankings, it's actually 200 more, not 300 more than the second place guy, but still at a staggering rate that he's utilizing that that splitter in particular. Now we're going to stay in on the West Coast with another player. This time, though, in the American League West, in Mitch Haniger of the Seattle Mariners, currently in his third and final year of arbitration, where if a deal can't be reached, you have a panel of arbiters to determine whether his desired salary or the team's desired salary will be what he earns for next year. So it's kind of an interesting situation in terms of how he's going to ultimately end up getting paid. He's currently getting $3.01 million this year. At 30 years of age, he was an all-star back in 2018, but he's dealt with some injuries since then. Had a back injury in 2020 that put him on the 60-day IL. 2019 also, the year before that, had a ruptured testicle injury. What do you guys say about how they should deal with him from moving forward in the future?
I'll go second on this one, being the Mariner guy.
Okay, I had to unmute myself for a second there. So I really like what Haniger's done this season. He's hitting for power. He's a guy that I'm surprised Alex didn't mention in terms of guys that could be all-stars. And I was actually surprised to learn that Mitch Haniger is a former all-star. He was an all-star in 2018. I totally missed that part, I guess. It was 11th in MVP voting. He's had a very strong season this year, 787 OPS, OPS plus of 120, playing right field for Seattle. So he's a guy entering his age 30 season that, like Gausman, you ask yourself, okay, how sustainable is this? How much of that nearly 500 slugging percentage can you carry over moving forward? And I think with Haniger, as strong of a season as he's had this season, he has 19 home runs. He's on pace for between 35 and 40. He's driven in almost 50 runs. I think you have to tell yourself that while he's good now, it could get ugly in a couple years. He strikes out a lot. He's not a great defensive player in right field, and there's not a lot of options. And if you're Seattle, I think you should kind of distance yourself. I know Seattle is doing really well right now. They're certainly better than I had anticipated. They're four games above 500 as of recording. But you have Julio Rodriguez. You have Jared Kelenic. I think you have to start. If you're the Mariners, you ask yourself, is Haniger in our plans moving forward? And I think the answer has to be no at this point. Could he be a long-term DH slugger for a team? Absolutely. But I don't think Seattle's that spot unless you want to move him to DH now and you get Rodriguez up, you get Kelenic up in the next year or two.
Okay. So I agree with certain points that you've brought up. Some I don't, some I do. With Haniger, he's a very young player overall. He's 30 years old, but he made his debut in 2016 at the age of 25. He has had some very bad luck when it comes to injuries, and that's honestly the big knock that I have on him, is that he just can never stay healthy, and that's always going to be a problem for him, especially if he can't get it at least somewhat under control. I mean, heck, though I will give him some credit, though. Most of the injuries he has been from freak accidents. Stuff that is not like, you know, weak bones or something like that. For him, it's been like the ruptured testicle that was mentioned. That was a freak accident.
Yeah, that was a fastball of a Justin Verlander, I believe.
Exactly, yeah. So with that one, and I will tell you this right now, when that happened, he was on fire. He was on fuego when playing just before that injury. And then starting out the season was picked up exactly where he left off. And it was the great big comeback story because he hadn't played since that game in 2019. He didn't even get to play 70 games that season and did not get to play at all in 2020. He's a good player. Defensively, he's okay. Like, he's not going to kick anybody out for his defensive ability. Overall, defensively, he's again, okay at best. This season is having a bad defensive year. But overall, right now, over his career, has a defensive war of 0.3. Offensively, when he is on fire. And that's something that is, again, a double-edged sword. So, for this, the reason why this is so weird is exactly with what Splash said. There are a lot of young guys that are coming up in the Mariner organization that are outfielders and very good outfielders. Jared Kelnick being one. Julio Rodriguez. Kyle Lewis is on a torn meniscus right now, but he's an AL unanimous rookie of the year. Take that, Luis Robert. But always will do that. But and then on top of it, there's also Taylor Trammell, who is also a very good player that once he's given his time, he's showing that he could be a very good player. Again, just needs a little bit of time to mature. I like the idea of trying to move him to DH. I'm not sure how sustainable that would be either. I would like the idea, though, a lot. Here's what I'm going to say with this, and I'm going to try and make this brief. If you move him to DH and you try to keep him as a platoon guy in the outfield, extend him. Because there's one more thing that he brings that a lot of players don't have, and that he has the fans back. The fans have his back. He is someone that the fans have latched onto. I don't want to say like a parasite because we're better than that, but we have latched onto him like glue. And he is someone that the team has rallied behind so much. He has helped this team through some really bad times and through some really good times. And he's one that is going to put butts in seats for Seattle. Just like Kyle Seager, I think they need to extend him too, by the way. But that's a story for another day. I think that overall, when it comes to this, Haniger should stay with Seattle. But if he does not want to be a DH and a platoon guy, he may need to go.
Is the injury history concerning for you, though?
Yes.
For
100%. So that's why I started out saying the injury concern is definitely a big concern for me. But I do also think that when it comes to it, that there are some bits that are freak accidents, and I don't think that his body is, like, you know, shambles. It's just not great, you know?
Yeah. I kind of was back and forth with this. I would say sign him. I wouldn't do with Gausman, but I would do even less for Haniger. I wouldn't break the bank. I would refuse to break the bank even less for Haniger. Probably wouldn't give him any longer than like a 3-year deal to 15 mil a year at most, probably. He's got a lot of pop to his bat. He's got some nice power. I would probably expect him to move considering his injury history with the back, with the ruptured testicle as well. It'd probably be better for him to move to designated hitter. I think it would be easier on his body. It'd be probably more suitable too, because he's not the greatest of defenders. Currently right now, he's got a 250 average with 47 RBIs and 18 home runs, slugging 497 with 16 doubles. So he's having a decent year. I wouldn't say necessarily all-star caliber year, but it's a good year. It's a good enough year.
Well, at the beginning of the season, remember, he hit 17 bombs in a very short amount of time. There was at one point this season that he was, I think, tied for the lead in home runs.
He was, yeah. He did get off to a hot start, but again, it's all about that, how you play down the 80-game stretch for the first half of the year, and he's kind of cooled off in recent days. So I would say sign him. I'm fine with it. I can understand if they were moving on because, again, this Mariners team, they're constantly either nipping at the heels of the playoffs or find themselves to be the consistent joke of the MLB when it comes to record. And I'm not trying to bash on your M's.
No, you're fine. Go for it. Trust me, you can't bash the team harder than I can bash them. It's fine.
The truth speaks for itself. I mean, I can only point out so many silver linings here, folks. It's been rough for the Mariners lately. And right now, they're 4 games above 500, so they're looking pretty good. But you've got tough competition in the AL East. You got some tough company in AL West, in the Houston Astros and the Oakland Athletics, who obviously top the division. Maybe they could generate a run that could be interesting, but a lot of things have to go right So I could see them moving on and just trying to rebuild and proceed to get younger as they have been lately with guys like, you know, thinking about moving up Kelenic, obviously, like they did earlier in the year. You know, Kyle Lewis, you know, J.P. Crawford is young. They got a lot of youngsters on this team. Really, Kyle Seager is the one, you know, elder statesman, so to say, that really is up there in age. That's, you know, obviously a catalyst, a key cog to their team. So I'd say sign him, but again, I'd keep it short because, again, the injury concerns, you wonder if that's going to come into play. I think he can generate a ton of production, but from hitting standpoint, but yeah, I would lean on him potentially becoming their future DH. Just, again, don't break the bank with him. But that'll do it for us here on Cheap Seats Chat. I hope you guys enjoyed listening into this episode. We certainly enjoyed partaking in it today and bringing you some of this interesting info and these interesting storylines that have played out in recent days. Once again, I'm your host, David Gillespie. Alongside with me was Alex Clark and Ryan Potts. You can find them on Twitter for Ryan Splash Potts at Mr. Splashman 19, and then Alex Clark at the Sports Guy 242. And you can also find me on Twitter at Davey G Sports TV. Thank you again for everyone tuning in, and we'll see you right here next time on Cheap Seats Chat.